right now, and Kepler is looking for that answer. That could be kind of exciting. That's item number one. Item number two, I hear tell that that stuck wheel on Spirit has somewhat come back to life. It wasn't a failed motor. Let me drop. That it's the drive circuit that commands the motor that has failed. And all of a sudden, the bad wheel on Spirit has come back to life. The bad wheel is back in operation. That's the good news. The bad news is two other wheels have developed a failure or a partial failure in the drive mechanism that's driving the motors. So they picked up one good wheel and suddenly lost two others. Well, don't cry. That particular spacecraft was rated to be used for 3 months, and we're more than 3 years downrange, and the darn thing is still working. It got stuck in the sand, dug itself a hole, so to speak, and all of a sudden discovered some very interesting stuff below the soil. They're a little bit worried now because Mars winter is coming, and they can't move the thing to the side of a hill where they tilt the solar array in the right direction, where during the wintertime it can gather enough power to keep itself warm enough. There's a slim possibility we're in the process of losing Spirit because it's stuck in the sand and can't get itself into a desirable position to protect itself for winter. Stay tuned. They may find a way to bring that thing back out of the mud, if you know what I mean. So these are some of the things I've heard, Paul. And maybe I've taken some of the wind out of your sail. I hope I haven't. WS2N, if you're available. K2RIW in the TechNet. And make sure you wait for the beep, Paul. And don't be like me. Try not to time out the machine. You got it, Paul.
Okay, fine business, Dick. WS2N. Space report. No, there's plenty of space topics, Dick, to go around. There's probably 1,000 active satellites right now in orbit. Interplanetary spacecraft. You know, you could take each guy in the net could take 10 satellites, and you'd still have more than enough to go around for space topics. Okay, on the Spirit, that's good to hear that. Well, you know, I'm not surprised the other two wheels are starting to fail. They've been stuck in that patch for many months, and they've been trying to get out. It's like talcum powder. And you're going to wear something out if you keep running the wheels and going nowhere fast. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of the problem, Dick. Kepler, yeah, well, the orbit is nice. I like the orbit. They've got that in the L1 position, the Lagrange position. It's about 1,000,000 miles out from the Earth, between the Earth and the Sun. As opposed to L2, Lagrange 2, that's where they're going to put the James Webb telescope. That's going to be on the away from the Sun. You know, it'll be Sun-Earth telescope. They have to work correctly. You can't send a space shuttle out there to fix it. That's a concern on these Lagrange point locations. Let me drop it. L3 is useless. That's no value. It's on the other side of the Sun. So they don't use that one. That's another position where the satellite will tend to stay there. 4 and 5, they call that the Trojan locations. We don't have any satellites located in those spots. But you could keep one there. Except you have to use a lot of fuel. They tend to move around much more than do at the L1 and L2 positions. I want to mention the WISE spacecraft there, the one that I said that looks like a gigantic R2-D2 from Star Wars that they launched. That has sent its first pictures back. That's the one being kept at 8 degrees Kelvin. WISE, it's the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. So, you know, it's the one that's down in the infrared. Got to keep it real cold so it doesn't see its own infrared frequencies coming off the spacecraft itself. So the pictures are back with that. They're just starting to tune that thing up, and that's the one that's going to take a survey of the entire sky. It's going to take a complete survey in 1 year, and then the next next year another survey. I believe it's a year and a half, 2 year mission. So I think they're going to get two and a half surveys of the entire sky over the entire mission. What happens is the helium, they're using hydrogen. The hydrogen on board will eventually completely bleed off, and then it won't be as cold as it needs to be to take its pictures. So much for the telescopes. Endeavour is now on the launch pad. Very cold down there. They showed the crews bringing out the Endeavour to the 39A, where it's going to be launched in February. I think February 7th. So if Eric wants to drive north from Pompano and just take a look at the shuttle, he'd have to stay there for quite a while to see the launch, but he could always go north on the way back, and, unless he's flying, and you'd be able to see the shuttle set up, although the service structure is probably mounted around it. Let me drop it. You know, when they bring the payloads out, you know, it's not put in. Payloads that I put in the shuttle, in the vehicle assembly building, and then board out inside the shuttle. They bring out the shuttle independently, and then outside, you know, then whatever the payloads are, in this case, you've got one pretty big payload, the new node, they call it. There's two nodes up there. The payload is boarded out separately and mounted into the movable service structure, which encapsulates the doors of the shuttle. The doors are open. Whatever payload is gets put in at that time. So that's what you would see out there right now. Yeah, node is an interesting node. There's been two put up there, but like I said before, and they named them. It's one called Unity, that's the first one that was sent up, and then there's eventually another one, Tranquility. The really six-sided structures, ports which could be used to either go to another room or another piece of the space station, or maybe you could put a docking cone on one end, and you could dock a shuttle or a Soyuz craft or an ATV. Automatic transfer vehicle that the European Space Agency is building. You know, it's a multi-purpose type of room that's being put up, and that's what the two previous ones have done. This is the third and final one, and that'll be attached. What I like about it, it has the cupola attached to it. Cupola is a viewing port. It's attached to the top of it. If you were to stand inside or stand upright in this room and float to the top, you'd be looking out six windows, actually seven windows, but it's six windows, trapezoidal looking windows. You'd get a 360 degree view, and then if you look straight above you, you'd be looking at a round window, 1 meter in diameter, roughly 3 feet in diameter. So you'd be able to look straight above your head, which would be looking down toward Earth, is where it's going to be assembled at the nadir position of the ISS. Drop it. And that's pretty much it, to give you an idea of the size of this thing. It's maybe 5 feet high, and diameter is like 10 feet wide. That's the type of this cupola, the dimensions that this thing is, that's going to be attached to the node. So it gives them more living space, and it gives them, most importantly, a viewing place. You'll be able to see all the spacecraft coming and going, and you'll see the last couple of space shuttles that are going to be going up to the space station, coming and going. It'll be kind of like a TRACON on Long Island. You know, you'll be able to get in there and watch what's coming and going, and with a tower at an airport. You know, you'll see the progress ships from the Russians coming up, and coming up, and in the future you'll see the Orion spacecraft coming and going. It'll be quite a sight. You could probably put maybe two people standing up in this thing looking out the windows at the same time, so it should be pretty cool. That's pretty much it, Dick. I hope Mel's got more about the balance tonight. That was pretty good last week. Back to net, WS2N.
Pretty fine. Glad you didn't time out. Came close, though. when it comes to surveying the background radiation of space and what it all means, the great big picture of the sky in infrared, I think the first spacecraft that did that survey was COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer. Then the next one that came along was WMAP, Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, I think it was. Wilkinson Microwave. But WMAP, Microwave Anisotropy Probe, yes. That one gave you a much, much higher resolution picture. Again, did two complete surveys, if not more. And now I think you're telling me the WISE is possibly doing an even higher resolution survey at 8 degrees Kelvin for its infrared detector. Is the WISE doing a further higher resolution total universe picture similar to WMAP? Did I understand that one correctly? And I happen to keep track of that one, and that's something I'm darn interested in, so give me a couple of words. Did I misinterpret what WISE is doing and how long it's been in operation? Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Make sure you don't turn my time out.
You know, I got a time up. I keep hitting the button, but I keep forgetting to look down and see how many seconds are going by. So I tried listening to myself on the input. That didn't go too well. It would take a couple of years to get used to that, you know, with the delay, Dick. That's what, you know, listening to the other machine. WISE, yeah, well, you know, it's really going to be looking for brown dwarfs and infrared galaxies, up to it, like, each infrared galaxy, you know, could hold like a trillion suns. These things are, you really don't see the infrared galaxies on the edge of the universe with the other frequencies that come back. But in the infrared, they do it. So that's what it's pretty much going to be looking for. It'll be looking for the asteroids and the comets and a lot of all, you know, these near-Earth objects that go by. And, of course, they'll be looking for the planetary debris and, you know, that's what it's really designed for, and not so much like the WMAP. That was looking for microwaves and the, you know, the leftover. Well, it probably started off as, you know, maybe X-rays or gamma rays when it first exploded. Now they've stretched out into the microwave world, and that's pretty much what COBE and WMAP were looking for. It's a little different there.
Very fine, Paul. Be looking forward to those results. Okay, now we're going to go back to the continuing saga, the continuing, hopefully, educational series. What is a balun? Why do I need one? Why do these things are so darn hard to understand? And there's an amazing number of people who have worried about balun. Do I have enough? Am I using one when I need to? Do I really have to use one? How much better will things get when I get one? You know, questions like this. So maybe a number of you guys went to the website suggested by Bill, WB2QGZ. Once again, it's Bitemark. Here we go. BYTEMARK, bitemark.com. Let me look at my actual, bitemark.com/products. / Tango Lima Tango Theory .htm. When you go there, you're going to see a number of balun. And let me turn it over to Bill, who made that darn good suggestion that we go there. We all have the same diagram in front of us to discuss. Of the 1, 2, 3, 4 at least kinds of balun. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, I think there's 4 balun there. It's your choice, Bill, your suggestion. Which one of those ballons do you think we should discuss first? What would you like to know about those ballons? Give me a hint of what you've got in mind, and we'll try to proceed from there. WB2QGZ, the guy who asked this good question, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick, I'm in a much worse place than I was earlier when I called in. If we can hit the two Guadellas, the 1-1 and 1-4, just kind of a general once over, as balanced and unarmed, I think that would be more than enough tonight.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but you came through very well. So Bill is suggesting that we go to the 1-1 and the 1-4, the two Grinnella ballons. Not the Ruff-Ruff, Grinnella, yeah. Well, there's a Grinnella 4-1. Let's go to the 1-1 first. On the first diagram of that suggested website, figure number 1. I haven't read the words that went with it. I'm only looking at the diagram, so I'm going to make a little bit of a guess. And that exact ballon, I found out that the company called Mini Circuits makes an extremely good one, by my standards, that works at 915 megacycles. Of all the antennas I've worked on in the last few years, and my name is on something like 17 patent applications for antennas that I have worked on in my consulting business in the last 5 years. So my name is on approximately 17 patents. Almost every one of those antenna applications, they haven't all been granted yet, almost every one of those applications is for an antenna for the 915 megacycle region, a so-called license-free band. And about 2 years ago, we discovered that a series of antennas we were working on, let me drop, needed a one-to-one ballon. And there's two or three different ways of making a one-to-one ballon. One of them is very similar to the schematic diagram that's on figure number 1 of that suggested website. Mini Circuits makes one like that. I wish I was smart enough to think of the model number of the one that I discovered. Mini Circuits makes, I don't know the exact number, but if I had to guess, 15 different ballons. And I ordered from them about 5 or 6 of their ballons and ran some exhaustive tests as to what is their quality for my particular application at 915 megacycles. Don't be discouraged by the fact that I was studying 915 megacycle antennas and you care about a ballon for 80 meters. The theory of operation is the same. So don't let that discourage you. And what I finally discovered is that of the 5 different ballons that I selected from that catalog that seemed to fit my requirement, I went and did further extensive testing. And 2 of them were okay. The 3rd one was not so great. And I guess it was the 4th one. Wow. That thing is dynamite. That thing gives me all kinds of common mode isolation at 915 megacycles. Lots and lots of dBs of isolation. And that's what I needed. And I couldn't tell that from the data sheet. Harvey Cayley, the president of Mini Circuits, did what almost every other ballon manufacturer does. They tell you it's a one-to-one ballon. They tell you what the input standing wave ratio is going to be and the output standing wave ratio or the exact impedances you're going to get on a Smith chart or on a S11 curve or whatever. Standing wave, I mean, a reflective voltage characteristic. S11 is a measurement that you make with a network analyzer. Let me drop. And S11 is a mathematical function called scattering parameter, but it stands for voltage reflection coefficient. You and I know what the standing wave ratio of an antenna is. We have some understanding of what it means. And we can talk, if we're a little bit smarter, we can convert standing wave ratio into reflected power ratio. In other words, if on my bird watt meter I know I send 100 watts up to the antenna and 10 watts comes back, I have a 10% power ratio. I might have a 0.3 voltage reflection coefficient ratio. I'm not sure of the mathematics, but you see the principle at least. I'll have to go back and double check that. So voltage reflection coefficient, which really is a way of measuring how much signal is reflected from the thing, whether it be an antenna or some other amplifier, whatever is the load for your transmission line, how much percentage of power or voltage that gets reflected is what we care about. In the ideal world, you'd like that to go to 0. And so I needed a ballon that simultaneously gave me very little reflection. The data told me that, but also told me the amount of common mode isolation. How good an RF choke is it? The poor man's balun you heard about many times is that when you take a coil of coax cable and coil it enough times with a large enough diameter and tape it together and put that poor man's balun close to your antenna, it is a kind of an RF choke that only works on the outside of the transmission line. The signal going down the center doesn't know it's going through a coil. It doesn't know that. But any RF energy that wants to flow down the outside of the line because of an unbalanced situation where a balun is required, that coil acts as a choke, and you get a certain number of decibels of isolation. Okay, a nice big coil of coax cable, in the case of an 80-meter dipole where you don't have a volume restriction up there on the top of the antenna. Let me drop. On the top of the tower, you don't have a volume restriction. That's a pretty nice way to go. But if you're building an ultra-miniature circuit on a handheld transmitter that's running at 915 megacycles, you may not have the real estate to do that. So you want to buy this tiny little transformer-like thing, and the mini circuit cells are a very good one, that behaved beautifully, gave me lots of dBs of isolation. Nowhere on the data sheet did it tell me the amount of common mode isolation, and it's a one-to-one balun. No one in his right mind is going to use a one-to-one balun to do an impedance match. It ain't going to match any impedance. 50 ohms in is 50 ohms out. The only reason you want a one-to-one balun is to get common mode isolation. That's the most important thing that that device has to do. And that parameter is not on the data sheet. I made a bunch of careful measurements, found out what the data was, reported it back to mini circuits, and said, you guys are foolish if you don't put it on the data sheet. You're head and shoulders against most of the competition in this parameter, and you didn't report that parameter. Craziness. This Grinnella one-to-one balun on figure one is one of those. You'll notice that it's got an input signal generator, which feeds R sub G, the signal generator, V sub G and R sub G, everything to the left of that V1 symbol. You've got a dotted measurement there from top to bottom, from lead number three down to lead number one. You've got a dotted line. Everything to the left of that represents the signal generator. In your and my world, let me drop. In your and my world, that V sub G represents some amount of power being generated, being represented as a pure voltage generator, an ideal voltage generator. The R sub G is the impedance of the generator. In your and my world, most of the time, we would adjust R sub G to be 50 ohms. So R sub G is a 50 ohm resistor, and V sub G is an ideal voltage generator. And on your schematic diagram, you make V sub G big enough in volts, RMS, so that it represents the amount of power you care about, like 100 watts, 10 watts, 1 watt, whatever. And with a simple calculation, you can probably calculate how many volts represents that number of watts on a 50-ohm signal generator. All right, so now you know what's going to the left of that diagram, to the left of V1. That signal is now going from your signal generator into pin number 3 of that circuit. The diagram is a little bit incomplete in that it doesn't show you that the coil of wire between 3 and 4 in that diagram and the coil of wire between pin number 1 and pin number 2 of that diagram are magnetically coupled to each other. On top of that, there's one other missing piece of information. If the diagram was done correctly, there should be a great big round dot on one side of the upper coil, and there should be another dot on the lower side of the coil. Let me see now which I can figure out which way to put the dots. I'm going to put a dot on number 3, and I think I'm going to put a dot on number 1. Those dots, if they were on the diagram, tell you the polarity of the magnetic coupling. So there really is magnetic coupling between that upper coil and that lower coil. And unfortunately, the diagram doesn't show you that. Let me drop. But if you knew that there's magnetic coupling, because this thing is probably wound around some kind of a transformer-like structure. Doesn't have to be, but that's the way to make it most compact. Probably a ferrite. It would be wound on a ferrite, and the dots, if they were present, would show you the polarity of the wiring. Obviously, wire number 1 and 2 could be wired on that transformer, call it the secondary if you like, and the primary call it 3 and 4, and I could adjust those to be polarity-wise in phase or out of phase. But when you get it correct, the bottom line of what happens is that the signal appearing on your two output terminals, pin number 4 and pin number 2 in the diagram, are thoroughly balanced with reference to ground. If, for instance, the differential voltage, the V2, happened to be equal to 2 volts, and you did a kissable measurement on that circuit, if that circuit is working correctly, at the time you make the measurement where there's really 2 volts of difference between pin number 4 and pin number 2, it really would be represented at one instant of time where your signal coming out is a sine wave at the RF frequency. Assume you stop time at the instant the sine wave is at its positive peak. You stop time, and you're going to discover what's going on at that instant. Let me drop. That 2-volt output from pin 4 to 2 would, with careful measurement, you would discover that at that instant of time that you stopped it at the positive peak, pin number 4 is positive 1 volt, pin number 2 is negative 1 volt with reference to ground. You now have a thoroughly symmetric output voltage from that Grinnell one-to-one balance. That's what you desired, even though the input was thoroughly unbalanced. Notice that the input, your signal generator, the pin number 1 is grounded. That's always 0 volts with reference to ground. And pin number 3 is the output of your signal generator being fed in. And pin number 3 would be 2 volts with reference to ground. So there's a 2-volt wave on pin number 3, a 0-volt wave on pin number 1. That's the continuous way you're feeding the input. Let me drop. And because of the way this circuit works, because of the polarity of, I'm going to call it the primary and the secondary winding, because of the polarity, which represents where the dots are represented, because of the magnetic coupling between the two, you now have an output voltage where, at that instant of time, pin number 4 will be positive 1, pin number 2 will be negative 1, and if I did a reanalysis where I went a half cycle down range to where the input voltage is not positive 2 volts, but the input voltage is negative 2 volts, and I stop time again and analyze what's going on, everything would be reversed. Pin number 4 would be negative 1 volt, pin number 2 would be positive 1 volt, but they're always, the two output terminals are symmetric with reference to ground. That's the main thing that circuit wants to do. It takes an unbalanced input and creates a balanced output. That's why it's called BALUN. It's a contraction of balance and unbalance. That's what it does. However, this thing does one thing further. Depending on the way this thing is designed, if my crazy load on the output side, pins 4 and pin 2, was something that created itself an imbalance, and I didn't know about it. In other words, I think I've got a symmetric load out there on pin number 4 and pin 2, the output terminals, and there's something funny going on out there that I don't know about, which creates an unbalance, where instead of being plus 1 volt and minus 1 volt on my first period of analysis, let me drop, if at that instant of time, the crazy loading of my circuit created a condition where the output is now plus 1.5 on pin number 4, and minus 0.5 on pin number 2, that represents a condition even worse than, you know, midway between what I put in, thoroughly unbalanced, and in the ideal thoroughly balanced output, I've now got something intermediate between the two. I'm half balanced and half unbalanced. If my load created that condition, your next question would ask, what would happen? And the answer is nothing. The signal generator would see no change in input impedance. He's still cranking out 2 volts. He's still seeing a pure 50-ohm load, and yet some kind of crazy output partial imbalance took place because of the craziness of my load that I didn't know about. So in other words, when this thing is working correctly, between pin 3 and pin 4, you think there's an RF choke. Between pin 1 and pin 2, you think there's an RF choke. As such, your differential output terminal, pin 4 and pin 2, can be any amount of balance or unbalance that you desire, and it creates no grief back at the input. And if my input happened to be a coaxial cable connected from the output of that signal generator going into my pins 3 and pin 1 of the input, the V1. If V1 of that diagram was being fed by a coaxial cable, the choking action that I just described with the partial unbalance of the output would create no current flowing down the outside of the coax cable. That thing is giving you perfect isolation if it's ideal, and yet it creates a perfect differential that keeps my load, which might be an antenna, thoroughly happy. That's kind of magic. Now, in the case of that really desirable mini circuit balance that I discovered, I made a careful measurement. How much choking action did I get? The answer was 1,450 ohms. In other words, if I had a 50-ohm resistor from pins 4 and pin 2, I properly loaded the balance. Let me drop. I properly loaded the balance with a 50-ohm resistor, and I made all kinds of measurements of grounding pin 2 or grounding pin 4, and I measured what I saw at the input. Nothing changed. And the next thing I did was to not make a pure 50-ohm resistor as a load. I used a pair of 25-ohm resistors in series. As far as pin 4 and pin 2 is concerned, it's still being loaded with 50 ohms. But because I had a center tap on that 50-ohm resistor, a 25-ohm resistor on the upper half, and a 25-ohm resistor on the lower half of the load, I took that junction and connected a signal generator to it. Connected a signal generator, it actually happened to be a network analyzer, looked back into that 50-ohm resistor, and what did I see? If the balun wasn't there, and one of those resistors was directly grounded, and the other one to the signal generator, I would see a ground on one side, 25 ohms from center tap to ground, that would be a 25-ohm resistor. The upper half would be a 25-ohm resistor going into a signal generator, a total of 75 ohms. Put 75 ohms in parallel with 25, I don't know what the exact number would be, maybe it would be 18 ohms. So from my common center tap, from my center tap of my phony 50-ohm resistor, which is really a center-tapped 50-ohm resistor, 25 up and 25 down. If the balun wasn't there, and I fed a signal generator back to that center tap, I would see something like 18 ohms to ground. Because I'm using that balun, I saw 1,450 ohms to ground. 18 ohms to ground, very undesirable, became 1,450 ohms, very desirable. The thing made a beautiful improvement in balancing characteristics, gave me the right output impedance, gave me very little insertion loss. I think I saw something like 0.3 dB of insertion loss, and I got all this great isolation. Some people will call that a current balun. Some people will call it a Unidella 1-to-1, a Grinnell 1-to-1. You can see the magic that that performed. And that 1,450 ohms of common mode impedance, which should have been on that beautiful Technicolor data sheet, was not there. And they left a lot of money on the table, in my mind, by not giving you the main reason, the parameter, the whole reason you would buy the darn thing, 1-to-1 impedance, not doing any impedance matching, but it gives you this great isolation, and they didn't tell me that. They kept it a secret. They're crazy. Okay, you guys might have a lot of questions on what I just told you. Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW on the TechNet.
KC2RXF listening.
I think it was KC2RXF. If you have a question or a comment, start off with your name, sir, and go right ahead. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Well, Dick, I'm going to be real quick. It's really a novice question to call KC2RXF. And I'm speaking from Kingsburg, New Jersey, County of Monmouth. Atlantis Pacific antenna, which is made by Diamond, a dual band antenna, SG7900A, dual band antenna, UHF, VHF. I'd like to know what your opinion and comment is on that specific antenna to be from those girls, and I'll be on the side.
I just went to the KC2RSF announcement at QRZ.com. I see a nice picture of a handsome-looking guy, and me for an opinion of a particular brand name of antenna. And I'll warn you that Mel and I usually don't say brand A is better than brand B. We don't get involved in that. If you were asking me the question, is a quarter wave ground plane better than a 5/8 wave ground plane when I mounted in the middle of the sheet metal of my car as a mag mount? Yeah. Now you're asking a generic question about an antenna type, and Mel and I love answering those questions. But if you ask me about a 5/8 wave brand A mag mount and a 5/8 wave brand B mag mount, which one is better, unless we just happen to have specific experience with one of those, where one of them fell apart immediately and the other one burned up, so to speak, we'll tell you that. But short of that, we tend not to give out information because we don't know. We don't own all of these brand names. And so I may not be able to answer that question. Now, maybe I misunderstood your question, Tom, but is that sort of what you're asking? What is my opinion of brand A antenna? And in theory, you're asking compared to all the other brands. And if that's what you're asking, as opposed to a generic type question, I might not be able to answer that one for you, Tom. KC2R Romeo Sierra Foxtrot, K2RIW.
See, I'm not very knowledgeable or very technical, and I don't really know how to articulate myself, other than it's an antenna that I'm very interested in and I'm looking into. And on VHF, it's a dB is 5 dBs, 7.6 dBs on UHF, and I just wanted to know if anyone knew of past performance on that particular antenna prior to purchase of it.
Okay. So Tom is asking us, this combined VHF-UHF antenna, where the manufacturer is claiming 5 dB of VHF gain and 7.6 dB of UHF gain, if anyone happens to have specific knowledge about that antenna, that they like it or dislike it. I'm a little bit doubtful that we're going to get a response to that, but I'll throw it open to the net and see if anybody says, yeah, I like that brand name, or no, I don't like it compared to so-and-so. If you happen to have one of those opinions, speak up now. K2RIW listening. As you can see, Tom, I'm a little bit afraid about that one, that we're not going to get an answer. Also, I'll warn you, your signal is quite noisy. Maybe some of the people tuning in didn't specifically hear what you're asking, and maybe that's making it a little bit more difficult. And the disadvantage you've got, Tom, is you're over in New Jersey in Keensburg, and you might be close to the null in the antenna pattern for this repeater. Because there is another repeater on 146.85 megacycles in New Jersey, and in order to keep compatibility between that repeater and this one on Long Island, they intentionally have steered a null in the antenna pattern in that direction. You might be close to that direction of null, and therefore it's making you more difficult to send enough signal in this direction to get good response. Your signal was quite noisy in this repeater, so that may be a contributing factor. If you had a little bit more power, a little bit more antenna you can aim in this direction, it would be worth a try. So, does anyone else have any questions or comments on what we've said so far on this one-to-one balance? Some people call it a current balance. It's called the Guinella one-to-one balance. And what is its magic, and why that particular mini-circuits product that I purchased and tested? Because I had to test it because the manufacturer, a beautiful manufacturer, a very inexpensive, high-performance, tiny little device, that works like a charm at 915 megacycles. I was very unhappy he didn't tell me, but we've added that to a commercial product that's now being manufactured, and so a good old mini circuits is going to sell a whole lot of them, we think, because of the testing that I did, I think, and as such, he's going to get a lot of business on a parameter that he didn't tell me about, and I wish he would have. Anybody have any questions or comments on this Grinnella Ballon that we just discussed? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Thank you for bringing it to its attention, the company.
QGN.
Okay. I heard Paul, Howie, and Bill in that order. Paul first, WS2N. Go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, but you know, I shortened that URL, tinyurl .com. I went over to that if you want the shortened version. It's 20 characters less than what you had.
Okay, so you've created a shortened URL. Why don't you give us that shortened URL so that people will find it easier to type it in the future and go to that website, which has these nice Bowen diagrams. Go ahead and give us that URL, Paul.
Okay, the only reason I did this, I was typing it in for the life of me. I couldn't spell the word theory. What is going on here? So I said, I better make a shortened version. Maybe some people have the same kind of a problem, mental block here. http://, tinyurl, that's T-I-N-Y-U-R-L .com. They all start off like that, by the way, when you get these things. I'm going to give it to you phonetically. Yankee, Foxtrot, Step, Gulf, X-Ray, Foxtrot, Gulf, USL.
Okay, so this website that gives you contracted URLs has http://, and I think it does not have www. So after, does not have those. So after the /, tiny, T-I-N-Y-U-R-L .com, / Yankee Foxtrot 7, Golf, X-Ray, Foxtrot, Golf. Did I get it correct, Paul? Go ahead.
QSL, nothing like phonetics on ham radio. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, well done. Howie, was the next question, a person with the next question or comment? Go right ahead, Howie.
No, it was just a comment or a question. Did the manufacturer say thank you? Are they going to put it in their data sheet? And if you're going to give them business, they must be happy. So do they thank you for it?
The answer is the ham radio operator, who is the local representative, he thanked me. The factory did not. To my knowledge, the factory has not yet put that into the data sheet. In a way, I slightly understand that. It's an extremely unusual measurement that I made with an extremely tiny circuit with very careful wiring, all done under a microscope. I created this center tap floating 50-ohm load, which is a 25-ohm, surface mount resistor. I think I used 04, 02 resistors, tiny little surface mount resistors to make sure there's no stray inductance. Let me drop for a second.
Dick.
So with these very tiny microscopic resistors on this microscopic circuit, I made this careful measurement that came up with 450 ohms of common mode isolation. Now, for the factory to take my particular unorthodox measurement and then put it on their data sheet, where although I used a laboratory calibrated Rode and Schwartz very well designed vector network analyzer, that's the method by which I made the measurement, I used good instrumentation to make a measurement that to me is traceable to the Bureau of Standards, but it's an unorthodox measurement because it's a center tapped floating miniature load, and I think I carefully controlled all of the stray capacitance to ground. Well, he could easily listen to somebody that sounds as enthusiastic as me, and that person might come up with data that's got an awful lot of error. So the fact that they didn't jump right on the bandwagon immediately and put that data that I came up with on their data sheet, I somewhat understand that. I'd like to believe that on their to-do list, they're going to take my description. I published a report and sent it to both the local representative and to the factory itself. And I'd like to believe they're going to put that on their to-do list in the future and assign one of their people in the laboratory to go out and make their measurement and confirm what I saw. Because I used their sample testing circuit that they supplied as well as the actual component that we're talking about. So I got partial positive feedback, as you can tell, Howie, but did I get complete success where they put it on the data sheet? No. However, it doesn't hurt me. It is hurting them. I'm going to continue to use the component, and I hope he will continue to manufacture it, because if not, if I have to go out and find a substitute, and just to make sure we've got a second source for that manufacturer, that's a fairly valuable antenna. I did find a second manufacturer of a similar product that doesn't perform as well. So I think I'll survive if I have to use the second component, the other manufacturer. But at least I've got two sources so that I'm not completely vulnerable. I think you see where we're going on that one. Not complete success yet, but I've got hope. Bill, WB2QGZ, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, can I reply back to your comment, please?
Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, this is about previous to the subject where you had the 25 on the... You were basically looking back at the 25 in series with the generator and then the lower resistor being in parallel. So you're right, it's 25 in series with 75. It's about 20 ohms. It's basically a 25-ohm resistor in parallel with the 75-ohm. That's what you're looking at.
You've got it. And if I put 75 in parallel with 25, I'm not sure what the exact number is. I said 18, maybe it's 20. In other words, without the balancing structure, I would have seen as a common mode impedance roughly 20 ohms. When I used this one-to-one balance, it cost me only 3/10 of a dB of insertion loss, not very much, but the 20 ohms of common mode impedance became 1,450. And it's something I needed, and that's a hell of an improvement. That's a big ratio of improvement. It did what I needed. It made my antenna invulnerable to common mode current flowing back on the structure that feeds power into the antenna. In the particular antenna I was worried about, the reason I needed this balance, I should have told you guys this, is the antenna is going into a handheld product that runs as a transmitter at 915 megacycles. It's an RFID reader. As a human being waves his hand in front of the antenna, he can wave his antenna on the left-hand side of the antenna. That creates one polarity of imbalance. Or he can wave his antenna on his hand on the right-hand side of the antenna. That creates another non-symmetry of loading of the antenna. I do not have control. Let me drop. I do not have control of what that human being, that is the customer of this product, is going to do when he waves his hand in front of that antenna. The handheld product is a pistol-gripped RFID reader with a display on the top of it. It looks like a handheld computer with a pistol grip, and it's got a squeeze trigger. When you pull the trigger, the transmitter goes on, and it reads all the RFID tags in the neighborhood. But the guy is waving his hands around that thing. He's creating various kinds of imbalance in that antenna that I don't have control over. Because of this Grinnell one-to-one balance, it doesn't matter to me. The circuit doesn't change the impedance the transmitter sees. Whereas that hand waving in front of the antenna would create all kinds of grief, and the transmitter would be extremely unhappy if I wasn't using that balance. That's the second reason it's there. I got a little bit of a gut feel for why I needed it and why I'm so happy it behaved so well in that mode. Okay, over to you, Bill. Don, good question you asked. WB2QGZ, K2RIW.
Just a question about the physical manifestation, the generic physical manifestation of magnetically coupled inductors. Could that be on a toroid? And how physically would that be ground?
Okay. Very noisy question, but I heard it all, and I'm going to repeat it for you guys. Bill wants to know, what does this balun really look like? The physical manifestation. Is it found on a toroid? Alrighty. When you look at this tiny little baluning device that I've been describing, where it was my experience with the product made by Mini Circuits, you look at it under a microscope, what do you see? You see a blob of, I'm going to call it ceramic material. Maybe it's a ferrite, I don't know. The material is reddish in color and very hard. When you scrape it with an X-Acto knife, not much happens. It looks like you're scraping a ceramic. So is it really a ferrite, or is it just a very strong insulating material? Right now I'm not sure. But it is a blob of material with two holes in it side by side. Not a toroid. It's a two-hole device. The input wire, the wire that represents lead number 3 and 4, the upper winding, is made out of enamel wire that is greenish in color, So the secondary, I'm going to call that the primary, the secondary winding from pin 1 and 2 is made out of wire that is enamel colored, that is red. So you've got red and green enameled wire. A certain length of the enameled wire is twisted together. So you got a twisted pair of red and green enameled wire. That twisted pair is then wound in one hole and out the other hole. That's one turn, and it's about four turns of the twisted pair. So about the twisted
next
pair is
at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
The twisted pair of wires are long enough so that the twisted pair twisted as one, considered as one continuous signal path, is wound through the two holes of this, what I think is ceramic material, and it makes about three turns. Because the wires are color-coded, and it's easy to see which are the two wires that are the so-called input end and the two wires that are the output end, it's very easy to see which is the beginning and the end of red, which is the beginning and end of green, and therefore you've got two solder terminals on one side of this pad that the whole thing is glued down to, and two other terminals that are the output side. And so the two terminals of the input side on that diagram would be called pins 1 and 3, and the two other terminals, which I'm going to call the output side, are pins 4 and 2. And now, are the wires crisscrossed and whatever? Because of the color code, because you know which is starting and stop, you can decide how to wire it so that the phasing is either in phase or out of phase. In other words, the dots on those coils, you could make the dots form any way you want by the way you wire it. So they've chosen the right combination, which I don't remember right now, so that it does all of this magic. So that's what you see when you look at it under a microscope. I wonder if that sort of fulfills your request there, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2RIW.
Yep, works for me, thanks.
Hey, a slightly noisy signal. Bill says it works for me. So that was Grinnell-Ballen 1-to-1, Grinnell-Ballen 1-to-1 impedance match, balancing device. The next picture is the Grinnell 1-to-4. And 1-to-4 is almost identical in performance to the one that we just discussed, the 1-to-1. The 1-to-4, when you study that diagram, and there's dots missing again from this particular diagram, telling you polarity. But once again, it's going to give you a thoroughly floating 200 ohm output, because that figure number 2 is called the 1-to-4 balance. If I fed the input from a signal generator of 50 ohms, and when they call it a 1-to-4, they're almost always discussing the impedance ratio, not the voltage ratio. And I think that's what they're doing in this case. I think they're talking about the impedance ratio, so therefore 50 ohms of in becomes 200 ohms of output. So if I had an antenna, for instance, let me drop. If I had an antenna like a certain kind of folded dipole, which presented a 200 ohm impedance, and I wanted to feed my folded dipole in a thoroughly symmetric manner, and I didn't want any current flowing down the outside of my transmission line, I would go to that diagram, which is called figure number 2, a 4-to-1, and it would do all of the magic that I just described to you. In order to test it, I would make a 400 ohm load by using a pair of 200 ohm resistors in series. I would first put on that 200 ohm load, the pair of 100 ohm resistors in series. I'd confirm that I get a reasonable input impedance, reasonably low standing wave ratio. Then, because one of those two input leads is grounded from the center tap of my 200 ohm load resistor, I would then connect a sensitive machine, like a vector network analyzer, and measure what impedance I had to ground. If the balun was ideal from the center tap of the 200 ohm load resistor, I'd measure almost an infinite number of ohms to ground. If I wasn't using this baluning device, I had nothing but a 2-to-1 voltage ratio transformer-like thing, which stepped up the impedance by 4-to-1. Remember that the turns ratio squared, or voltage ratio squared, aspects of the way transformers behave. A 2-to-1 turns ratio gives you a 2-to-1 voltage ratio, but it gives you a 4-to-1 impedance ratio. I know it sounds crazy at first. You just have to accept that. Let me drop.
Sir, make a comment here, please.
In a minute, I'll let you make a comment. So, if I didn't have the balancing device, I would measure something like 100 ohms to ground. No, I'd measure something like 60 ohms to ground. With the balancing device from the common center tap output load looking back into this balance, I would have something closer to infinity in ohms as opposed to the 60 ohms that I just guessed at. So it gives me a non-vulnerability to unbalances that the outside world might create with my antenna. That folded dipole might be a 40-meter folded dipole, and maybe one side of the dipole is closer to a great big massive tree compared to the other side, adding a whole lot of capacitance to one side, unbalancing the dipole. At first you say, hey, that's terrible. With this kind of a balancing device, that wouldn't have any effect on the performance of my antenna or the standing wave ratio I would see or any common mode current flowing down the transmission line. It gives me all of that benefit with essentially no disadvantage other than a slight insertion loss and maybe a slight power limit depending on how I physically set up this balancing device. So it gives me a lot of desirable characteristics, very few undesirable characteristics, and it gives you a lot of benefit once you understand why you use a balun in the first place and why it helps you get protected from something in the environment that you don't have complete control over, like where that tree is, where the wind is blowing that tree, and where a hand, in the case of a VHF handheld product, where the customer puts his hand near the antenna. Go ahead, Howie, with your question, K2LIW.
It's not such a question, Dick. You may want to spend a few minutes on transformer theory, explaining that you have a primary and a secondary. You can say the turn ratio gives you the voltage, the turn ratio gives you the current. They're inverse, and you can show that you can figure out the impedances, and then you can show the 4-to-1. You know, if you have 10 volts on, 100 volts on the primary and 10 volts on the secondary, you know, the current will go up. If you have 1 ampere on the primary, then you'll have 10 amp on the secondary, and you can go through all the simple mathematics and then show, you know, n squared. You know what I'm talking about. That might be something you want to go through more elegantly than I can. Go ahead, Dick.
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Howie. In the case of figure number one, the first balun that we've discussed, the first Grinnella balun, the 1-to-1 balun, in the way you normally use a transformer, you have what you and I call a primary winding. I could call pin number 1 and 2 of that diagram the primary winding. I could, if I want to, call pin number 3 and number 4, that winding, the secondary winding. If I was directly expressing voltage from 1 to 2 on the primary, and if the turns ratio was 1 to 1, from 3 to 4, I would measure the same number of volts if the transformer was ideal. A 1-to-1 transformer, same number of turns of primary, same number of turns of secondary. If the transformer was working correctly, whatever voltage in that case I put on the primary, I get essentially the exact same voltage on the secondary. That simple transformer action. Turns ratio equals voltage ratio. That's the good news. But diagram number one, figure number one on this website, shows that I am not using the transformer in the conventional manner. I'm not directly feeding the primary. I'm not directly feeding the secondary. I'm not directly putting the load across either the primary or the secondary. I've got this other crazy winding, a crazy diagram. I've taken the whole damn transformer with its four wires, four leads, four terminals. I picked the whole damn transformer up. I rotated it 90 degrees, and I put it back down into the circuit. That's sort of what I've done schematically with figure number one. So there's more going on than just transformer action here. Yes, if the transformer is ideal, let me drop. Whenever you and I decide to build a transformer, the first thing you have to